Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peake, and welcome to episode 261 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, wow, putting herself in touch with racism, with systemic racism, and what's that about with your body, huh? Yeah, hit the pause button. This is going to be an amazing show. Before we begin, know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils, customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your first really official reminder now, hello, to click on to iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show. We look forward to hearing from you. Heck, I'm the one who looks forward to hearing from you because your feedback is absolutely golden. Love to hear from you. So we'll be reminding you a little bit later on, but here's your first reminder. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast,
the naked truth about women,
her mind,
her body,
her life.
It's all about her.
So I'm scrolling through the New York Times, as I always do. The headlines are amazing and the features are even more extraordinary. And oh my God, here's an opinion piece with a picture that just absolutely flipped me out. It said in the headline, "It's not obesity, it's slavery." We know why COVID-19 is killing so many black people. That was the subtitle. All right, you got my attention. And I read this extraordinary piece by an academician, Dr. Sabrina Strings, who's an associate professor of sociology at the University of California at Irvine. And I said, that's it. Got to get her on. Because as you know, I'm a physician and a Pew scholar in nutrition and metabolism. And forever and a day, I've been yelling and screaming about why are we not talking more about the insidious causes of why there are such disparities in healthcare delivery, access, et cetera. But now that we have COVID kind of stripping away a lot of the trappings of what we thought were the origins of why, for instance, COVID is really affecting the black community, suddenly we're now down to some bare bones here. And I think everyone, we need to listen up, and there's no one better to help us with this. I think at this time, especially with what has just happened with George Floyd and all the rest of this, incredible times for us to just hit a pause button and listen up. Dr. Sabrina Strings is the author also of Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia, another extraordinary piece, which we'll be talking about as well. Sabrina, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why'd you write this? What got you to write this amazing piece, this opinion piece in the New York Times? What was going on?
You know, as it turns out, I had been telling many people the story of being in the room with some of the most important scholars in the field of public health and then also economics, and how they were musing over black people's poor health outcomes. And when they turned to me, the only black person in the room, and asked me about my thoughts, I said, well, slavery. And I didn't elaborate. And they looked at me quizzically, and it wasn't the only time I had issued one-word answers in those kinds of meetings, because when I first arrived, I thought, I don't belong here. You know, I've only had a PhD for 2 years. How is it that I'm in this conversation? And then I subsequently realized that given my lived experience in the black community, not to mention my own training as a medical sociologist, I had a particular type of information that they seem to be unaware of. And but nevertheless, they should be aware of if they were willing to read up on American history. So I thought it was important for me to sit down and write out how this particular manifestation of Black people's severe complications with COVID and high fatality rates with COVID was nothing new, and that it goes back to slavery, and it's part of conversations that Black people have been having about Black health outcomes for decades, if not centuries.
Wow. All right. Like I said, you got my attention. Oh my gosh. I only wish, all I can say is, Sabrina, I only wish I was in that room, like a little fly on the wall, to see everybody's jaw hit the floor. You know, sort of a big collective clank. You know, like, what? Slavery? The hell? And meanwhile, people like myself, you know, I'm come from the University of California at Berkeley, and I have a master's in public health. Yeah, I'm a UC person. You know, go Bears.
Go Bears. I'm also a Bear alumnus.
Yeah, man. So I'm saying, you know, I did my undergraduate and graduate there before I went to medical school. So I am an epidemiologist. So when this whole COVID thing happened, all of a sudden we have a situation of the emperor has no clothes, right? Suddenly we're like, yeah. Wait a minute now. Hello. Why is it that in Louisiana, like 70% of the people on ventilators were obese Blacks, and all they did was they stopped at obese Blacks? They didn't say, wait a minute, why is this happening? Are you like, you know, going to shake a little finger at them and say, well, you know, you really should be eating more healthfully and getting a hell of a lot more exercise. What are you, crazy or something? Are you
exactly.
Do you know where they live? Do you know what lack of access to medical care resources, you know, exist? Do you know how long this crap's been going on? Do you know about their own cultural beliefs, you know, when it comes to really trusting, you know, the healthcare system after the Tuskegee, you know, nightmare, which a lot of people still, you know, don't remember and all the, it just goes on and on and on. So at the end of the day, you know, who's been going deeper with all of this? So it's been you. So when I read this, I fell off my chair. Thanks to you, I had bumps all over my ass. And I said, I got to get you because you really have nailed this here in a big way. So let's go to, you know, the whole slavery thing. Help us make this connection.
Well, when we think about the era of slavery, it's important to keep in mind that during that time period, it was profitable for white slaveholders to keep Black people only marginally healthy, because being optimally healthy is rather expensive. That would require you to feed them the best available food, make sure they have access to clean water and healthy movement, not to mention medical care. So it didn't make sense. It wasn't profitable for slave owners to put that much time, energy, and effort into what was ultimately their human property. Instead, what they did was try to keep them just healthy enough to have them labor effectively on the plantation for the time period in which they could have been optimally productive, so probably between the ages of, let's say, you know, 15 to 40. But then after that, you know, their lifespan would have been shortened and it would have been of little consequence because they were not viewed as equal human beings. When slavery ended and we transitioned to the Reconstruction and then ultimately Jim Crow, there was no moment in American history in which easy access to healthy foods was made available to African Americans. There were clean and safe places for people to get water, for people to get exercise, that they could have access to medical care. I think the medical care element has been well documented by the likes of Harriet Washington. So there is this ongoing history from the era of slavery, so beginning 400 years ago, of Black people having marginal access to all of the things that we know help keep people safe and healthy. And so when we look at COVID-19, the temptation is to say, what's happening with this disease? And then to turn to diabetes and say, what's happening with diabetes? Oh, well, what's happening with coronary heart disease? It's like we can no longer look at the many different illnesses that are impacting the Black community in a vacuum. We need to see them as systemic. All of these things are rooted in racism. And unless we are willing to confront our past and make the commitment that we're going to do better by marginalized communities, you know, especially the Black community in the future, then we can expect that Black people are going to have elevated rates of serious complications and fatalities from most serious illnesses.
Wow. Spot on is all I can really say, just spot on. One of the most important things that you're really having us confront is the fact that there's a baseline foundation that was set up a couple of hundred years ago, where the Black community was never given access to the very basic critical elements that were needed to be able to establish health and wellness. They just didn't have it. If anything, you start with that and then you move on. You move on to the stress of being looked upon very differently. And you know stress hormone when it's there on a chronic basis. I happen to be a stress hormone cortisol physiologist in addition to most of my work at the NIH. One of the things you find is that you keep doing that to someone in little bits and pieces every day, as my best friend who is African-American, Naomi, told me. She said it's like a death by a million paper cuts. It just kind of never goes away. It's always there, you know, a little cut here, a little cut there. And if you don't think that that doesn't impair immune function, think again, because it does. And so you already have that as this underlying undercurrent, right? And then you top that with just a slew of what we call comorbidities, or a bunch of chronic conditions, which basically amp up inflammation in the human body. And the greater the level of inflammation, from diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, for instance, cancer, et cetera, the more you have an elevation of inflammation, the more you impair immune function. So, duh, of course, you know, mm-hmm. COVID's basically got a welcome mat into that human body. I mean, it's just the way it works. And so then you say, oh my gosh, you know, it's all about the obesity. Can we just go a little behind this obesity thing for just a second now? You know, how do people, you know, put on weight in the first place? What's going on with that? What about that quality of food? What about the stress and comfort eating? What about cultural eating? What about anything that has to do with eating within the Black community that we really totally don't understand? You know, what's that all about? And I think that we're just now beginning to appreciate that. I'm a physician to this day. I mean, seriously, Sabrina, they still don't offer nutrition in medical school or nursing school, for that matter, as a separate required element that is covered on our boards. Okay, go ahead, wipe the shock off your face. That's insane. That's crazy. I had to go outside the system and become a Pew Scholar, you know, after I finished my official training, because I didn't get it in my training. I thought, that's ridiculous. But we're still like so far behind the times. And what you're doing with your work is you're calling us to task on that. You're saying, wait a minute, you don't even get it. Where do you think this came from? What do you think this is all really all about? Am I correct with this?
I think that it is important to educate people about nutrition. But I also think that sometimes that becomes the primary message. And what that misses is the reality that there are many people who don't have the ability to eat healthy, even if we tell them simply to do it. And this is one of the major things that I like to talk about as a medical sociologist, because when I began my research into the relationship between, in quote unquote, obesity, which is, as many of your listeners know, I'm sure, measured today as having a body mass index of 30 or greater. When I started doing research on this, because there were so many reports in the early to mid aughts about Black women's higher rates of obesity, I thought, well, what's contributing to that? We don't imagine that it must be genetic or in some other fashion biological, because of the fact that if that were true, then we wouldn't see that rates, that weights are changing over time. So I was very interested in that in the beginning. But then ultimately what I realized was that a lot of the obesity science research is in and of itself flawed. So when we're thinking about health outcomes, weight may have an impact on health, but I want to make it clear that this is simply a proximate relationship. It is not the ultimate cause of Black people's poor health outcomes. Sometimes it is simply a confounder. Sometimes it's a mediator. But it's difficult to know because so much of the research is simply looking at the correlation between BMI and health outcomes. And what that misses are all of the different contributing factors that may be both increasing BMI and increasing inflammation, and then ultimately leading to negative health outcomes. So to give an example, I started doing research on food insecurity about 5 years ago. And what I found was that for many people, not having access to a sufficient amount of food, right? Notice that I didn't say healthy food. I said a sufficient amount of food actually contributed to weight gain. So it's counterintuitive for us to start talking about eating healthy or eating less when we're considering populations that are so marginalized, they cannot even get access to enough food so that they are not hungry and that the hunger itself is driving the weight gain. That's how I became interested more so in the broader factors that are contributing to poor health outcomes amongst Black and then also Latinx communities.
You mind if I just ask you, Sabrina, what got you so interested in this in the first place when you were beginning your studies as a medical sociologist? What grabbed you about this whole sector that you're talking about right now that made you so passionate about it?
Well, you know, Pam, I don't often talk about this particular aspect, but growing up, I was very close to my grandmother, and some other people might have heard me tell stories about her, you know, being confused by why there were so many white women on diets when she moved to California in 1960. But another aspect of my interest in this is that my grandmother died from complications related to diabetes in 2000. And given that she and I were so close, I was devastated, you know. Looking back in the 1990s, there were many times in which I would take public transportation with her from Pasadena to downtown Los Angeles, which is like where USC General Hospital is located. And for those of you who are unaware, taking public transportation from Pasadena to Los Angeles is nothing short of a day-long excursion. It would take us approximately 2.5, maybe 3 hours to get there. Then we would sit in the waiting room for hours for her to be seen for 15 minutes, and then we would take that trek back another 2.5 hours home. It was a full day. And I remember thinking, even as a young person, how is this healthcare? She spent her whole day trying to be seen for 15 minutes because of the fact that my grandmother was, you know, living on SSI, Social Security. And so when you're thinking about low-income Black people, and especially Black women and their poor health outcomes, I had an intimate relationship to that growing up. I got to see what it meant for an older Black woman to have little access to healthcare and how that ultimately led or contributed, at the very least, to her demise at the age of 67.
Oh, wow. And was she obese?
No, my grandmother was slender, actually.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Huh. And so it was that, you know, the reason why I ask is for all of us who, you know, have done research and work within these fields, it's so interesting how it our passion is born of these very personal relationships and personal experiences. And mm-hmm. when I asked you, I knew I was going to hear something extraordinary, and I did. And that is that in amazing relationship you had with your grandmother, and you having to literally experience with her what she had to go through just to be able to access what she needed for baseline care. And exactly. And that, you know, that had to, you know, affect you quite deeply. And isn't that interesting? I'm so happy then that in the midst of difficulty lies opportunity. You know, you kind of ran with it. You said, okay, there's a lot more to this that I need to understand. And most importantly, that you need to message to the rest of the world. That's how important this is. Talk to me then about where racism comes in, okay? So we have this, you know, the inequity and back and forth. A lot of people would say, well, okay, the Hispanic community and there are other marginalized, as it were, communities, but there's something distinctly unique about the Black community. Can you help us understand that?
Yes, so I will take us back to something that I touched on just a moment ago, which was my grandmother sort of being curious about the whole phenomenon of white women dieting. So my grandmother was raised in a rural community just outside of Atlanta, Georgia, and then traveled west in 1960 as part of the second wave of the Great Migration. So there were a lot of African Americans who were finally leaving the South and venturing to what they hoped would be greener pastures in the Midwest and then also in the West. And when my grandmother arrived in Pasadena, California, and was living for the first time in an integrated community, she was struck by so many white women being on diets. Like, what does it mean to be on a diet? Where she had come from, she was constantly teased for how skinny her legs were. You know, there are all of these like strange leg disses that she was constantly subject to. Peg leg, pencil leg, skinny, you know, a chicken leg. And so I remember laughing about that, you know, with her when she relayed that information to me later when I was a teenager. But one of the other things that would commonly happen is that she would just sort of bring me in to the living room to like marvel at the slender white women on television. And she's like, why are these women killing themselves to be thin? And it was maybe about 10 years later, after my grandmother had already passed, when I started thinking very critically about this question. I thought, you know what? We don't really know what slenderness means to white Americans, and especially to white women. Many of them have critiqued it as being oppressive, and I think that's a fair critique. But we also have to keep in mind that for those white women who happen to be slender, especially the ones that have money, that carries with it a great deal of social currency. So there's something to this. There's definitely a racial element to slenderness and the value of slenderness within our within American society that has been underexamined. So that was the beginning of my investigation into this. And what I found in my research was that prior to the slave trade, voluptuousness was prized within European communities, especially Western European communities. And we know this because of all of the artworks that we see by people like Titian and Peter Paul Rubens, some of the most revered painters and philosophers in Western history. But the slave trade interrupted that ideal, because with the slave trade and the rise of race science came the idea that actually fatness is a problem because it's an index of racial inferiority. Because look at how uncontrolled and sensuous these Africans are, especially African women. So they refined and they reformulated their own ideas about what attractiveness meant. And so for Western Europeans, as early as the 18th century, the new idea was that it was important to be slender because this was evidence of self-control and propriety that proves our racial superiority.
Oh, and then you also bring this up in your book, and you say that the Enlightenment era cultivated a belief that fatness was evidence of savagery and racial inferiority. Tell me about that.
Yes. So when we think about race science, what we're often thinking about is, you know, the idea that there might be some hierarchy of races in which Europeans were at the top, and then sort of various other groups that we would today deem people of color, such as Asian Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans, might be in between. And usually we recognize that Black people are at the bottom. And this is why we talk so much especially right now, about the significance of anti-Blackness to the entire globe. But part of what they were doing was not just saying that there was the scale of humanity based on skin color. And it wasn't just about their presumed color. It was also about many other characteristics. It was about intellect. It was about affect. So there was this idea that Black people didn't have the same emotions and they didn't experience pain the same way. There's a lot of researchers who are still doing research on this whole connection between racism and the perceptions that people of color don't experience pain the same way. But then also the idea that for whatever reason, only some groups have the ability to control themselves. Especially within the slave trade, you can imagine how there might have been the motivations to suggest that Europeans were the only group that were able to manage themselves effectively, because it creates the rationale for the continuation of colonization and slavery. If the idea is that Black people cannot control themselves, well, then how could they possibly govern themselves? This is how, for a lot of liberals, even during the era of slavery, slavery was believed to be a benefit to African Americans, because it provided individuals, they believed, according to race science, to be childlike, to have a caretaker, people who were really trying to help them in their path toward civilization.
That's just extraordinary. And you know, what I'm loving about this is you're giving us the one thing I think the mass majority of people don't have. Guess what? Historical context, right?
And that's so important.
Are you kidding me? And I think a lot of people just plain don't know the history. Now, this is also the kind of history you're not going to hear in grammar school. You're not going to hear in high school. When are you going to hear this history? Tell me, right? So, you know, I went to the University of California at Berkeley. Okay. You know, you could probably, you know, get some pretty damn good courses in it now. No question about it, because now we have that history. We have medical anthropologists, medical sociologists like yourself. We have other people who are really digging deeply into this and trying to wrap their heads around how it now figures into what we're doing today. And I think you've got a lot of eyes opening. I sent your article to like a gazillion one of my colleagues. You know, seriously, I said, read this damn thing, get back to me. And every one of them said, not one of them argued. Not one of them. Not one of them pushed back and said, man, that's crazy. Every single one of them said, yep, it's about right. No question about it. And you know, then I said, but what are we doing with that? What are we doing with this information? This is insane. You know, how are we now taking this information that you, Sabrina, are bringing to the light through your book, through your research, through this beautiful opinion piece you wrote? How are we now running with it? What would you see us do?
I think that because so much of my work has been pushing back against traditional obesity science, one of the most important things that we can start to do as researchers is to end this idea that we can somehow change health outcomes, especially for Black Americans and other marginalized communities, by asking them to lose weight. That is very simple but profound change that we can make. We can simply stop telling people that if they lose weight, that their health issues will be resolved. Because as you were talking about at the outset of this podcast, racism is like a thousand minor cuts. So it doesn't matter if a person is Black and they lose weight, because the stress of being a Black person in America is nevertheless still going to be contributing to poor health outcomes. But if we tell people who are experiencing these kinds of stressors and happen to have a BMI greater than 30 that they should lose weight, guess what? We're contributing to their negative health outcomes because of something known as weight bias. Fat stigma is real, and it is a tremendous contributor to poor health outcomes for individuals deemed overweight or obese. So it's one of the easiest ways that we can improve health outcomes is just to simply stop stigmatizing fat people.
Okay, and then what I like to do, I'm going to segue off that, Sabrina. The way I've started to look at it, you know, a long time ago, because, you know, just walking up to someone telling them to drop weight, I thought was sort of stupid. It made no sense to me whatsoever. Because did you understand the context within which one of my specialties is child abuse? You know, the whole issue of abuse per se, and basically trauma informed a type of context. So when you actually look at that and you tell someone who has sustained a tremendous amount of abuse, which, you know, you could really look at as very much what has happened in the Black community, it is, you know, trauma. The way they've been raised, within the context within which they try to live and try to thrive, et cetera, et cetera. It's very trauma-ridden. That in and of itself contributes to a comfort eating and also a really inflammatory relationship between stress and fat, especially visceral fat. That was actually the subject of a lot of my own research. And so one of the things I did instead was I just went to the origins. I went back to, okay, tell me how you were raised. Where were you raised? Tell me about your life. Tell me your history. I want to understand you. What's going on in your family? What's going on in your world? Those questions were never asked before. They just weren't. You know, it was more like, okay, this should be BMI, and it was all metrics driven. You know, like, here's your hemoglobin A1C. Yeah, you're diabetic. Wait a minute. Did you ever ask anything about their own cultural beliefs, about their own trust or lack thereof of the, and I quote, healthcare system and its interests in them, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, where are we coming from with any of that? And when you actually take the time, which never happens in traditional medical care, but when you actually take the time to listen, then all of a sudden, one, you're honoring that person by listening to their history. You're honoring them. I'm listening to you. I respect what you're telling me. And now what I'd like to do is work with you to enhance your health and well-being. Let's look at some simple things that can be done. And then instead of making everything weight-centric, you go to health and well-being centric. And you find out that, no, a lot of these people aren't gym rats and they're not going to suddenly hit CrossFit all day long. I'm not going to do that. But I'll tell you what they love to do. Dance. Hell yeah.
Right, yeah.
Get out there and dance and just let it rip, man. You know, and who wouldn't want to take a nice walk in the park with a couple of your BFFs? I mean, that's a beautiful thing. Who wouldn't want to go out there and throw the ball and the frisbee with the kids, you know, wherever you may do it, at the park or wherever? I mean, come on. How about we do something that's just beautiful and magnificent and honors that person's culture, environment, and their ability to be able to just enhance their life that way? What about that? What are your thoughts?
I think that's great. So I have a friend who was really big into Zumba. And,
oh, yes. Hell
it's
yeah.
It's a wonderful way to move your body and listen to music. You get to sing and laugh and dance. And who wouldn't enjoy that? Right? And my friend is Latina. And I thought about the fact, and I talk frequently about the fact that I'm a yoga practitioner. And in the West, yoga is often presented like it's a form of exercise, although it's not. It involves asanas or the postures that we're all familiar with, like downward dog.
Right,
but
right.
It's much more holistic than that. But one of the things that she and I were reflecting on is that when she goes to her Zumba classes, there's a lot of Black and Latino women in there, which is wonderful. That's what you want to see. You want to see a diversity of individuals enjoying their lives, you know, and moving their bodies. But when I am in yoga spaces, I would find that it was largely white. And I thought that was really fascinating because there's this way in which we often think that there are certain types of movement that are authorized as, quote, exercise, right? And there are kinds of things that are often prescribed. And again, I'm a yoga practitioner and a teacher, so I think it's a very valuable tool, but it's not something that everyone wants to do. I understand that. And for a variety of different reasons, it's not necessarily been made accessible to low-income communities or communities of color. So when we encourage people to find healthy ways to move their bodies that they can enjoy, that make them happy, then it doesn't seem like they're being scolded or stigmatized, but that they're given the opportunity to simply celebrate their lives. And who wouldn't want that, right? That there's the kind of thing that I want to do more of in the future, actually, is to offer more of the kinds of culturally relevant opportunities for health and wellness that people can get into, and not because they're being told that they need to change, but because they find it enjoyable.
All right. Now, now that you brought that up, now we're in the wonderful world of celebrities, entertainment, whatever. You know, what influence have these, especially Black female entertainers, had on this entire subject of, you know, of really understanding the female Black body? So when you look at these actresses, when you look at people like Beyonce, you know, you're not seeing the Taylor Swift thing, right? You're not seeing the little sort of almost stick thin thing. You're seeing women who have curves. You're seeing women who have a behind, you know, and a beautiful one, I might add. and you've got this whole different thing going. You see this in fashion now, too, you know, with the whole issue of, I love using that term, plus size and the rest of it. That's a plus size from a minus three,
right,
up, you know.
Yeah.
So like, plus what? You know, where did you start with this? So if you're not a double zero, you're nothing, you know, kind of a thing. And if you're a size four, you little fat person, you. So how do you think a lot of this, all of this stuff that's going on right now, is it a real influence? Is it a meaningful moment, a milestone, or is this just a passing something? What's going on?
I would want to hope that we are seeing some type of sea change. But I want to state at the outset that we need to be cautious about suggesting that this is a revolution, because one of the other things that I found in my research was that when we think about the slender ideal, many people assume that it began in the 1960s because of Twiggy. I'm sure that you are familiar with Twiggy. She was a huge supermodel in the 1960s, and everyone thought that she was the genesis of the moment of slenderness rising to prominence. However, as I've already mentioned, slenderness is an ideal that has existed for more than 200 years. And so what happens is that at various historical moments, thickness, as it's often known, more curvaceous or voluptuous physiques, will rise to prominence. And that's what we're seeing right now with the likes of Rihanna. And obviously, we have to talk about the Kardashians, right? Because they're such a huge influence on mainstream and especially white culture. So there are these sort of blips on the historical radar of thickness being valued before ultimately thinness making its return. And so I think it's important that we're beginning to find more curvaceous physiques attractive and healthy, but I don't think that we can yet say that the slender aesthetic is entirely gone, because when we look at the runways, as there have been so many news reports, runways still fade to white. Runways are still overwhelmingly women who are approximately, you know, 90 pounds. And so we don't ever see at the upper echelons of society the most elite actresses, the most elite models being anything other than extremely slender. And this is how you know that perhaps we have a long way to go before we can proclaim that we have truly embraced a variety of different body sizes within our society.
Oh, yeah. Amen to that. And I'm also thinking of Serena. Okay.
Yeah.
Serena and Venus. I mean, hello. You've got curves that are rock hard. You've got a very different kind of body, a magnificent body. Very different than Navratilova, you know, when she was, you know, doing her thing as the top of the tennis world. You know, muscular, don't get me wrong, but nothing like Serena. Serena's like in a class all by herself. And I need your help with something, Sabrina, you know, as we're kind of bringing all this, you know, around here. So here's the help I need. As a physician, in the back of my mind, and I know that of so many of my colleagues at the academic level, out in the, you know, front trenches and all the way through, you know, they, when they think of obesity per se, and, you know, newsflash to everyone out there, the United States is one of the leading countries in the world for the incidence of obesity, which is almost 43% of adults. And so, you know, now we're going to take a pause here and go, huh, okay. So when you have a healthcare system that has taught the providers at multiple levels, not just doctors, multiple levels, that obesity is highly associated with not great outcomes, you know, in terms of morbidity, you know, sickness and death, mortality. So immediately you have a healthcare system that pivots to that place and wants to correct it to help you, right? To help you. Now we're seeing that there are levels of complexity here that we need to appreciate and respect. That there's no easy fix, like, damn it, you know, stop eating so much and just exercise some more and grow up already. That you know, eat less, move more thing, no, that's so last year. This is so much more complicated than that. And that, you know, a lot of people, though, just see obesity, you know, as providers, as something that needs to be corrected, that is truly associated with more sickness and definitely early death, because of all the chronic conditions that oftentimes are associated with it. So when you say, well, stop having providers say, drop the weight, now the providers are sitting there saying, say what? But that's what I was trained to do to help this individual so they live well and live longer. All right, now I want you to provide the response to that.
I would say that we have been telling Americans to lose weight for decades, and they're not losing weight. One thing I also want to point out is that health, or rather life expectancy in the United States continue to go up. So this is one of the curious things that I think people should pay attention to. We keep harping on people to lose their weight. They're not losing weight. Actually, Americans are gaining weight, but they're also gaining in life expectancy. That's something interesting to take a look at when we're talking about this sort of curious correlations. I want to point out that the BMI cutoff of 30 is arbitrary. As I describe in my book, Hearing the Black Body, there was an entire debate that took place over the course of a little more than a decade, being led largely by a physician by the name of Ansel Keys, who was suggesting that, okay, we need to have this very clear cutoff for weight as it pertains to what we deem to be healthy. And I think it's important that I stated it exactly that way, because even in his own language, he described it as arbitrary, right? He's like, well, we move from one arbitrary standard, that of the standardized weight tables that came from insurance companies, to a different arbitrary standard, that of body mass index. And this is what we deem to be healthy. If we can accept the fact that the BMI cutoff was at one point 25, and then at a certain point it was 27, and then it was different cutoffs for men and women, and then it became 30, if we can understand that these shifts were not motivated by medical findings, but instead by arbitrary ideas of physicians about what would constitute a useful standard, then we can also accept the fact that there's no reason why we have to keep using this going forward.
Oh, boy. And I'm going to add an extra little layer of interest here. When you mentioned the arbitrary sort of scale measurements, as it were, that were based upon the Metropolitan Life Insurance statistics. All right, here we go. So it's bad enough we didn't even include any kind of, you know, racial diversity in that. But we screwed women, too, because those numbers were actually based upon young white males in the 1940s and 50s who were in their 20s because they were the only ones who were ever measured because they're the only ones anyone ever got life insurance on because women didn't have life insurance. So
that's right.
So now all of a sudden we have these numbers that were based upon young, healthy, white males, but we never once measured a woman, let alone a woman, you know, of color. So here's what they did. This is the part that, you know, I had to sit down and have a moment. Right? They just extrapolated. They go, well, you know, let's see, women, they're probably, you know, a little less than, let's make a difference of 20 pounds. What the hell? You know, and I'm sure someone was sitting around some dinner table with a lot of wine going, and there's making stuff. It was what I love to call MSU, make stuff up, just make it up. So, you know, what? I'm a scientist. Of course, that's like, you know, a mortal sin. You know, you have to do things like, you know, radical things like measure and be accurate and precise. So they never weighed a woman. They never weighed any woman. They just made it up. So when I heard that, when I was in my training, I had to suck my own breath and go, what? You know, and then I suddenly realized there's a whole lot of making stuff up going on. And that's how they've been doing it. Then we came to another moment, which was, wait a minute. There's actually a spectrum of body types. Who knew? So you've got little skinny people over here, you know, the Somalians and the little, you know, kind of very slender people and you know, the ones who always win the marathons and whatever. And then you've got like Serena on the other end, you know, who, you know, could lift a building. And then you've got all these other people. Are we appreciating all of that? Do we understand? How are we measuring health? How are we actually understanding that? Now, tell me what your thought is.
I think that your final question is so important. How is that a measure of health? This is what we have yet to be able to articulate, I suppose, within the public health community. It doesn't seem to be doing that. And that's one of the reasons why I've been a vocal advocate of eliminating BMI altogether. And this is not to say that there might not be some relationship between health and weight, but it's not BMI. And whatever it is, we have yet to find out precisely how to calculate it. But we're not going to get somewhere by constantly simply refining this particular tool. And once we do figure out what it is, we need to be flexible in realizing that given a person's history, their culture, their geographic location, there's going to be all kinds of reasons, their genetic makeup, why weight might matter on an individual here, but not on an individual here in the same way. We need to be flexible and take into account the holistic experience of living in a human body. And once we can do that, we can really start to make some gains, I believe, within the medical community in these health disparities that we've been talking about for so long. We're not going to change anything by telling people the same message that we've been giving them since at least the 1990s. If we are absolutely invested in improving the situation, the health outcomes for Black Americans and other marginalized communities, we must be willing to change our approach. And the new approach must absolutely be more holistic than the old one.
Sabrina, as you're well aware, there has been an extremely tough event in American history with the death of George Floyd. And this has brought to bear many, many issues. And this has actually put the whole theme of racism on a world stage. You and I have been talking about the profound effect of racism as it affects the health and well-being of African Americans in the United States. Do you think that what happened recently with the George Floyd death is going to open more doors in a more welcoming way to embracing the profound effects of racism at multiple levels, including in health and well-being?
You know, this, what we're seeing right now with the public response to the George Floyd murder has been so incredibly uplifting. There have been protests across the United States and globally, actually, against police brutality and against anti-Blackness. And in the space of a couple of weeks, we've seen some tremendous movement. As obviously many people may be aware, the Minneapolis City Council dismantled their police with the expectation that they were going to reinvent policing in that city in an entirely new way, which is incredible, right? Something that would have been unimaginable even 3 weeks ago is now presumably a reality based on their own proclamations. So I think that it is so important that people continue to protest to make change in policing. But the broader question, of course, is what's going to happen with some of our other social institutions, right? It's not just policing that is killing African Americans disproportionately. It is, of course, as we've been talking about, also health outcomes. The medical industry plays a role, and an unwitting role in many instances, but a role nevertheless. And I think what we have to be willing to admit to ourselves is that we don't yet have all the answers about how to address the ramifications of slavery. We talked about how those impacted health outcomes for Black Americans, but keeping in mind that slavery was also the moment in which policing, as we know, in the United States was born. You know, policing was an outgrowth of slave patrols that were ultimately institutionalized. And so we need, as a nation, to be willing to look back at all the many ramifications of slavery on the lives of Americans, right? Black Americans critically, but other Americans have been negatively impacted by slavery as well. And start thinking about how can we address the many different institutional failures that all of us are experiencing in this moment. It really requires almost a radical imagination of how we want to live going forward. It's not just police reform, although that's one thing, but all of the many different ways that we live our lives that lead to negative outcomes for Black communities, Brown communities, Asian communities, and even white communities. How can we make our system work for everyone and not just the privileged few? These are the difficult questions that I certainly don't have all the answers to, but I do think it's important that we start thinking about these things on a massive scale at this time.
All right. That couldn't have been said better if anybody tried. So let me ask you as we close, What are you looking at now? What's your current research? What's really driving you now? You've done this beautiful work. So now you're at the University of California at Irvine. Tell me, you know, what can we all hope to be hearing in the future from your research? What's going on?
Well, anyone who asks me that question gets a different answer because I have so many different interests. And so I'm always working on a variety of things at the same time. But I think one thing that you might be interested in, and hopefully your listeners will be interested in as well, that I am actually working on a project that is specifically about Black women's contributions to Los Angeles. It's not just about healthcare, but so many times when we're talking about Black people, we're noticing the disparities. We're noticing the negative health outcomes, or we're noticing the disproportionate impacts, for example, of COVID-19 or policing. But what if instead we were to transform what we pay attention to? What if we were to look at all of the many beautiful contributions that Black women in particular have made to some of the most important cultural productions that we all prize? We think about the importance of journalism. We think about the importance of Hollywood, the economy. Black women have made critical contributions in all of these areas that have been underappreciated. So one of the many books that I'm working on right now is Recovering the Importance of Black Women to the Creation of Los Angeles, one of the largest economies in the world.
Good Lord. Okay, I'm exhausted just listening to you. And of course, you're going to follow that up, Sabrina, and that's just one little project I have. I have like 35 more just like that. Are you going to be doing anything more within healthcare per se? Anything that touches on that?
Yes, I'm currently working with A. Janet Tomiyama, who is a psychologist at UCLA, on a series of papers about health outcomes and the role of social and historical factors. So you can keep an eye out for those. Hopefully those will be published, one is imagining, within the next year. But I don't yet have another book project that's specifically about health, but there will be a number of different op-eds, interviews, and again, these more scholarly publications that will be coming out soon.
So can you do us all a favor, Sabrina? Just keep on doing what you're flipping doing. It's just fabulous that someone's asking these questions. And I'm going to encourage all of our listeners to please get on over and buy Dr. Sabrina String's book, Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia. It's an absolute mind blower. I mean, I can't even begin to, right? And then, you know, if you want to read her op-ed in the New York Times, just Google Dr. Sabrina Strings, that's S-T-R-I-N-G-S, and the name of the article was, It's Not Obesity, It's Slavery. And this was just absolutely amazing. And this came out on May 25th of 2020. And I really think that you need to read this, and we all need to take a moment and start asking ourselves some deeper questions here, because I think we're all having that moment in history right about now. Wouldn't you agree, Sabrina?
I do. Yeah, this is a critical time for change, and so I hope that it's going to be transformative in all the right ways.
Oh, my God. Well, all I can say is I'm just thrilled to have done this interview with you, because I know you expanded my mind big time. And I know for a natural fact, I can speak for our listeners and say, we are deeply grateful for your work and deeply grateful for your articulating such important milestone moments in our history that we need to now begin to appreciate, honor, respect, and integrate into the way we think as we go forward. Sabrina, I cannot begin to thank you enough for being on the Her podcast.
Thank you. This has been a great conversation.
And everyone out there, okay, I warned you, here's your second little moment here. Run on over to iTunes, rate and review the show. So just click on iTunes, rate and review, because I know I'm going to want to hear from you about this discussion. This was profound at the very least. Ah, loved it, loved it, loved it, Dr. Sabrina Strings. All right, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Her podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode, just like this one, of the Her podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today. Stay safe and stay well. Oh,